welcome. The number, your number has significantly been reduced. I don't know what happens. Is there a competitive lecture? Or perhaps people will show up later. So last time we, in the end, started to collect the operations to be performed in order for realizing a function call. Now let us briefly also look what happens when the function has terminated. Then when the function terminates, so hopefully there was a return value, then this return value somehow must be kind of made visible to the outside world. So that means to the caller. So that is somehow the return value must be stored somewhere, and in particular in a place which is accessible from the outside. And then we somehow have to switch the context from the function to the caller. And that means we have to restore the corresponding registers, namely the frame pointer, by that we kind of leave the current stack frame and move, return to the former stack frame. And also the extreme pointer, in order to kind of re-establish the bound of for stack consumption of the caller, and then clearly we have then to return to the code of the caller in order to proceed there. And finally, we then, having done that, we are in the world of the caller, and everything which might be left additionally on top of the stack from the stack frame of the called function is now garbage and therefore should be removed. And that is the popping of the stack. So we see here, we have, so these kind of, these activities can be grouped into two things. First thing is this storing of the return value and kind of restoring the old environment that we collect into the instruction return. And then popping of the stack. Okay, so to a certain extent this popping of the stack can be done by the return, but there is some more stack to be popped, namely if you have a variable number of if you think of the actual parameters, these might be might be removed by the caller, because the caller knows how many arguments it has passed. So this is a new, an extra instruction which we might require. This is a slide. So then, having done that, we can kind of simply conceive the schemes, kind of translation scheme. For let's start for the call. So for the call, so here's a call, G applied to to E1 to EN, where G is not just the name of a function, but an arbitrary expression which may at runtime evaluate to the function to be called. So then, as we have said, we proceed as follows. We first put the values of the actual parameters onto the stack. And we do that by calling in a right-to-left fashion, by generating code R for each of the arguments and concatenating it in a right-to-left fashion. So that means we first execute this here. We first execute this here. So that we first at runtime, we will then evaluate the rightmost argument first and leave the value on top of the stack. And then we proceed until we arrive at the leftmost argument, which is then left on again on top of the stack, and therefore this is the topmost thing. So then comes this mark. We said the mark will put the organizational registers. This will be put on top of the leftmost argument. And now it is only then that we try to determine the function which is called here. So that is only then we kind of try to evaluate the expression signified here by G. So we evaluate it and we do it in code R. So that by that we get the value of this, and then hopefully this is an address which is resides then on top of the stack, and then comes the call instruction which uses this address to jump. And then once, so now after the call, control is transferred to the caller. The caller will execute to the callee. The callee will execute, and once the callee has terminated, control returns to the caller, and that is in this it returns here. And so now this the caller then does this final amount of garbage collection, and this garbage collection is by sliding down the result of the computation m minus 1 steps, where m is the size of the actual parameters. So the return value, as we kind of have agreed upon, has size 1. So therefore, this is on the topmost, occupies the topmost cell of the formal, of the space where the parameters have been expected, and then it is moved down. Yeah, so we kind of note, and kind so what I already have mentioned last yesterday, namely that parameter passing is by value, and therefore the actual parameters are all evaluated by the code R. So evaluate to a value. So that is the code which we generate for the evaluation is this code R. And then also this G function, this G is an expression, and we also determine its R value. That is kind of interesting. And this R value should provide the start address of the call function. And this should, so here somehow this remark thing has kind of disappeared here. So, and the idea, the observation is, sorry, let me just go one. Okay. Now, if you have the like for, so in that sense, function names are considered as pointers, code pointers, and like arrays, they are constant pointers, meaning that their R value and the L values coincide. So if I determine the R value of a function name, then this will evaluate to the, will be the L value of that function, namely just the start address. Yeah. And likewise, if interestingly, interestingly, for in C there is some weird thing going on. That is, if you have a name G, which is a function, and you make a star in front of it, this doesn't make a difference. So it's kind of that is so in that sense, no difference is made between a function and a pointer to a function of that type. And that is kind of a weird thing and a little bit of mind-boggling. The best way understand it is to assume that there is some kind of normalization going on. That means that the dereferencing of function pointers is considered redundant. It's kind of normalized away. So if there are stars in front of a function, then they are simply ignored. And that means also, if we want to pass a function pointer or a function as a parameter, we simply may write this function as the parameter. And then the R value of that will simply be the start address of that beast. Yeah. And so in that sense, so that means, so that kind of solves the case for passing functions as to parameters to other functions. Then there's another thing which we might wonder. We have what happens if we pass a struct. So currently we cannot. So a struct is not a single memory cell, but then we kind of can consider the following rule. If we wanted to pass a struct by value, then we first then we need a sequence of code instructions which produce these this struct or a copy of the struct on top of the stack. And this is done so we can are not so currently we are not able to realize that by our instructions. So we need a new instruction. This is this move k, and so the idea is we if we want to move determine the r value of a struct, we do it in such a way. We first compute the l value of the struct, which is an address, and place it on top of the stack. And then we use a new instruction, which I have called move. And this move instruction takes an address and copies a sufficient amount of memory cells on top of the stack. So here is the picture. Move expects an address on top of the stack. And then here in this case, if it is a move 4, then it will move 4 elements on top of the stack. Yeah, and so that is the what we expect from the move. Now, these are comments to this kind of scheme of generating code. I have not yet explained to you how in detail the mark operation works, how in detail the call instruction works, and how in detail the slide works. So now we have kind of, I have the obligation, or if you had conceived this translation scheme, you had the obligation to provide implementations of these placeholders, if you like, mark, call, and slide. So here comes the mark. So mark, we said, is called after the evaluation of the actual parameters, and it installs on top of the stack two organizational cells. Namely, it saves the extreme pointer and the frame pointer. And it does so in that way that it first puts the extreme pointer and then puts the frame pointer. Yeah? That's it. So this is all of what mark does. Yeah, so it's from the organizational cells, still the continuation address, the PC old, is missing. So this instruction will be pushed by the call. So the call instruction is executed after the evaluation of the function in the call. So there was this G, which we expect to be an expression. We determine the R value of it. So this R value of it should be some kind of address which is on top of the stack. This is the situation when call is called. Now what will call do? Well, it will put this one into the PC. But at the same time, the call is the last instruction in the caller. So it is the continuation address where execution should proceed after the call is just the next code position. Now this next code position is exactly the current value of the PC, because recall the PC is first incremented and then the instruction which is loaded is evaluated. So the PC here, this P, is already the address of the next instruction after the call. So therefore, what the call does is to exchange these two things. Yeah? And so that means in the end, we have saved the next the address of the next instruction to be executed, and we have put the address of the called function into the PC. So that is what happens here in these instructions. So here and there. And then we do one more thing, and that is we kind of additionally set the frame pointer. So that is something which we also delegated to the call instruction. We could have made it also a separate instruction, but since this is the last, this happens among the last activities inside the caller, so we kind of integrated it into the call. So that is additionally, we set the frame pointer. So this is the frame pointer set to the current top of the stack, which is the topmost organizational memory cell inside the new stack frame. Okay? So I may kind of comment one more thing, that the call instruction kind of saves the return address and additionally puts the jumps to the start of the call procedure. That is something which is often supported by hardware. So if you look at, so there's something like jump and link or so, such kind of instructions. I think jump and link is a PowerPC instruction, but I guess I'm sure in other processors it's the same. So this is exactly this. It exchanges the value, these it on the one hand side jumps to something, but at the same time saves the current PC onto the stack. Okay? So that's our call instruction here, which is a little bit tailored after what is supported by hardware. Okay, so now we have the call. Now let's see at the slide. So the slide expects a value, which is the return value of the function on top of the stack. And then slide would simply kind of moves that value sufficiently many steps down there. In that case, it puts it M, slide M would squeeze out M memory cells. So now we may ask, what happens if we have a procedure? Well, then in a procedure there is no return value, so we could either do a slide M and then a pop because there's no return value, or we simply have something like that we do an M plus one. So we simply pop, and that kind of means if there is no pop M, we could kind of invent some pop M to kind of simply subtract M from the stack pointer. Okay. So now here is then, so that was what we do at the call. Now that the question is, what do we do at when we translate a function itself? So that is the declaration of a function. So we said we have two more things to do. Once we have called the function, the first thing is the function must executing the function must install the missing parts of the stack frame, and that is, it has to set the extreme pointer. For that, we had this instruction. We had this instruction enter, and it also has to provide space for the locals. This is done by this instruction alloc, and then comes the code for the body, and then afterwards, once the body has executed, the function has to return, and for that we provide a new instruction return. Okay, so that's all. And now we have some obligation. We have to provide this enter, this alloc, and the implementation of the return. And perhaps one more, two more, more things. So here is the enter receives a constant. This constant Q is the maximal, increment of the stack pointer over the frame pointer. So how do we determine that? So the first thing is clearly we have to mark off, we have to, at least the stack, the required stack space for executing F is, consists of the locals, the space for the locals. And on top of it, we have to kind of add the maximal amount of local stack space. Local stack space is required for doing expression evaluation. And therefore, we have to do a calculation how much extra memory do we need for evaluating the expressions in the program. But that can be statically done, and we will see in examples how we do it. And then we simply add that, and this gives us the maximal stack space which we require for a call to this function f. Okay, and then this k here, this is the space, the size of the local variables. That is easy to determine because we have the size of function for the types, and then if it's a list of declarations of the locals, then we simply sum up their sizes, and this gives the k. There should be a little, only one little caveat that I here kind of make the simplifying assumption that in the body is organized as follows: that first you have the declaration of the variables, and then you have the statements. But in C clearly you can mix that all up, and you can declare the variables whenever you need them. It is interesting then to ask ourselves what will the compiler do in that case. Will the compiler kind of have this dynamic allocation of further locals? What is your experience? So it could, the compiler could do it in this way, but compilers typically do it in such a way that they collect all the locals which are allocated somewhere and allocate them all together right at the beginning. And so in that sense, what we do here is not completely unrealistic. Okay, so here is the enter. So the enter Q sets the extreme pointer to the stack pointer plus Q or frame pointer plus Q, which is the same in this situation. And now that is the situation when everything goes well. Things could go wrong, namely when setting the extreme pointer, we may collide with a new pointer. So that is the stack, the possible stacks, that there is not enough stack space available. And in this case, there is no possibility to recover, and therefore we raise an error, stack overflow, and quit program execution. At least this is what C would do. Now alloc. So alloc is easy operation. We said we want to provide space, stack space for the locals, and that means we simply increment the stack pointer by k if you have alloc k. Okay, and once again, this k is a compile time constant, so this could be 100 or 20 or what, and so then in the code we would have alloc 20. Okay, so now comes, so that was at the beginning. Then there is another instruction which was responsible for the returning from a function call. And this return instruction, so what does it do? So assume that we have this situation here to the left. That is, the frame pointer points to organizational cells of the current stack frame. On top of it, here in this area, so let us make it perhaps green, or no, black perhaps. In this area, we have the locals, and perhaps some local stack of the called function. So when we return, we kind of, the locals are no longer necessary, they can be popped off. Those registers which have been saved here would have to be restored into the respective registers. So this means that these have to be put there. And this means all three. So we have to recover the PC, we have to recover the frame pointer and the extreme pointer. And then that's all. The only thing is, again, the extreme pointer changes its value. And as soon as the extreme pointer changes its value, we have to check whether it whether there's a clash with a heap, whether the extreme pointer exceeds the new pointer, and if so, we again flag stack overflow and quit. Otherwise, things are fine and we may continue. And now after having recovered all the registers, the stack pointer, so all that part here is kind of removed, and the topmost element is the value returned by the function. And please note, this value is that we store in the topmost address below the organizational memory cells. Okay, so that's it. Now you can say, okay, so now we are done with functions, and that is true. Only with one minor exception, we have I have provided you with a scheme how to maintain the locals on the stack. But I have not provided you with means of accessing these locals, because the instructions which we currently had were always absolute addressing. So that was the only thing which we supported. Now we need something to do local, to addressing of accessing and addressing of local variables and formulas. And for that, we have agreed upon that we will use the current frame pointer. So that means if we have a variable x, now we have to make a case distinction, namely if it is a global whether it is a local. If it is a local, then the L value of x can directly be read off from a row, because we have the address and then we take that address. Now if it's a local, we can also take the relative address from the row, but this relative address is not the address of the variable, but only the address, the kind of the displacement of the frame pointer. So starting at the frame pointer, adding this relative address, we arrive at the real address of the local. So therefore, in order to do that, we have no possibility so far to construct that value, and so we introduce a new instruction. This is the load relative constant j. And that means I do not load J directly on top of the stack, but the sum of the frame pointer plus J. So that is here what's going on. If the frame pointer is F and we load the relative constant J, then we do not put J on top of the stack, but F plus J. Okay? And so now can access the real address of a local variable x, so that's fine. And so we can load from there, and we can store into that variable. But it is a kind of nuisance, because we then always have to use these combinations. So first load this relative constant j, and then load from there, or load the relative constant j and then store there. And so these kind of, reading the value of a variable or storing a value into a variable are frequent operations, so we again allow ourselves to provide shortcuts for these are abbreviations, or if you like, macros, for these combinations to the right. And so these should be kind of be seen in analogy to the shortcuts load absolute from J or store absolute at J, which also were the combination of two such instructions. Only that in that case of absolute things, so then we did not need this R here, but loaded the constant directly. Okay, so now we can access the locals and like we could access the globals. So this kind of saves us here in that. And then there's one more point. If we have inside our C program something like return E, what does that mean? Well, return E means two things. Return E means that we have to evaluate E. So that's the first step. And then we have to communicate that to the outward world, that we do by kind of writing it at this position in our stack frame where the return expects the return value to reside in. And that is the memory cell immediately below the organizational cells. Relative to the frame pointer, this has address -3. So therefore, we simply consider that as we store at relative address -3. Okay? And then, after a statement return E, the program execution will leave the current call of the procedure and return to the caller. And therefore, the translation of the statement therefore consists of three things. First, evaluate E, an instruction sequence which determines the R value of E. Then we store that R value that is kind of on top of the stack. Then we store that at relative position -3, and then we return. Okay, so in that sense, return E is, if you like, a particular assignment followed by this return. Okay, now it's time to do a little bit of an example. Let's look at the factorial function. So here we have a recursive function, so we have to do something. So there is no locals, but there is a formal. And accessing the formal is like accessing a local. So now for the body. So we have first the enter and the alloc, and at the end we have the return. So that signifies, and then we have also the first address, the first instruction is kind of labeled by the name of our generic label signifying the entry of a function. Okay, so now the factorial function has an if then else, so therefore here is a condition, and the condition is followed by a jump at zero to the else part, so therefore here is the code for the else part, and then it has a then part. And the then part is kind of here. Sorry. The then part kind of is terminated by this immediate jump to the end of the if then else. So let's see. So we have these, the if then else has these three portions. So let us first look at the condition. So we check whether the formal parameter is less or equal to zero. So now the formal parameter, there's only one, so it has relative address -3. So therefore, this one determines the R value of X. So this one is the R value of the constant, computes the R value of the constant zero, and this one is the comparison operator. Okay, So now in the then comes the next portion, the next green portion is what happens in the then case when the condition is true, and then when the condition is satisfied. In that case, we have to return the value 1. How do we do it? So the return 1, so we have to determine the R value of the constant 1, which is done by this instruction. Then we store that value in the position for the return value. This is at address minus 3. It happens to be the same address as the where we had the formal parameter. But then we do the return. We don't need the formal parameter anymore. Okay? So that was the then part. The else part is x times factorial applied to x minus 1. So we have to first do the we put the x on top of the stack because that is the first argument of the multiply. Then we have to do the call. So the call is we have to evaluate x minus 1. So we put the R value of x. We put the R value of 1. We subtract. Now we have determined the actual parameter. Now we do the parameters are processed, so therefore we mark off the stack. We call this instruction mark to store the organizational cells, the two organizational cells. Then we have to evaluate the expression for the function. So that is there we have fac for factorial. So the R value of that is loading the constant underscore fac. Now we have that the address of the function to be called on top of the stack. Then comes the instruction call to do the call. And now we are done and we wait for the result. And once the result has returned, then we do the slide. So that is the slide. The slide 0, why slide 0? The total amount of space for actual parameters is 1. And we have to subtract from this 1 the space for the return value, which is 1. So 1 minus 1 is 0. Therefore, slide 0. Okay? So now that means on top of the stack we have the result of the recursive call. Then on top of that we have the old value of x. Then we have to do the multiplication. And then we store the result because that is what we return. We store the result at relative address minus 3 and return. And then behind, at the very exit of all our of the whole procedure, we place return. That therefore we have this return here. So now clearly, you may say, okay, so this code can be improved. How can it be improved? So once you return, you need not jump. You cannot jump anymore because that one is not reachable. And the same here, this instruction here, you could have reached it only from this jump B, which is not reachable, or from the return above, where there is also not reachable. So therefore, this could also be removed. So, but that is kind of a particular, and then there's another thing here, this slide 0 has no effect, so it could also be removed. So we can remove these, and this would be correct in that particular, for that particular function call, but I have not done that, because I wanted to show to you how one would systematically produce code, and it is an extra, one needs extra arguments to and consider special cases when these garbage instructions are not required, and to provide schemes which take care of these extra cases clutters them and makes them more complicated and more difficult to understand. So therefore I have left them in and leave it kind of to a post-processing phase where one may kind of try to collect such useless instructions. One may also comment that these useless instructions are useless in that sense that they make the code longer, but they don't make it wrong. So at least this jump B and this return instructions, these could kind of be, they are not harmless because they will never be executed. And there are not so many of them, so that the code is not, it does not explode by keeping them in. So we could, so it's no harm to keep them in. This slide zero is of a different style. Slide zero has no effect, and therefore executing it would be like a knob operation. But that slide zero, that this is a knob operation, can easily be detected and then removed. Now there's one more thing which we might reason about, and that is one placeholder, and that is this Q. That is, how far do we have to put the extreme pointer? So how much stack space will be used? So then, therefore, we have to look at the expressions. So there is one expression here. And so there are two arguments placed on top of the stack, and then the operator is applied, then the result goes again, decreases again, so it's 2-1. So the maximal amount of stack space required here is 2. So I should make it in black. So it's 2. So now comes then this this part here. So how much stack space is needed here? So we load a value, then we store it away. So it's only 1. So the extra stack space is only 1. So this is, okay, I record it, so that is only 1. So then we have another expression to be evaluated, which is here. And that is, we place, we have 1, then we have place another copy of the variable x, then a third one, which is 3, then we subtract 1, which is 2. Yeah, so that means up to that green portion, the maximal amount of stack space is 3. Now comes the mark. The mark is called once there is two things are left on, are already on the stack, namely the 1x and the x minus 1. So these two, then comes the mark. How many stack cells will put mark on top of the stack? 2. So this is 4. Yeah? This is, so at that point, we have 4 stack memory cells to put onto the stack. Then comes the load constant factorial. So this is another one. So this is at that point, we have 5. And then comes the call. The call will kind of kick off one element from the stack and push one element of the stack. So after the call, it is still 5. So this means the maximal amount, and then comes the slide zero, then things will drop again, because then the stack frame will be popped. That is, at that point, before the multiplication, we have 2 elements on the stack, then we multiply, it's only 1 element, and so on. So the stack shrinks again. So we see that the maximal amount of stack memory cells which we require is 5. Okay, so you can see the kind of argument which we could apply. So at every point in the code, we may determine how many stack cells have been put onto the stack when reaching this broken point, and the maximal number which we see in that way is the maximal amount of stack space. In our situation, in our case, it is 5. Okay, so that means we may safely set Q to 5. Is there a question? So that kind of terminates our discussion, or concludes our discussion on the translation of functions. Now let us see what we do if we have a full program. What do we do for a full program? So then we have to kind of, when we run a full program in our virtual machine, we first have to initialize the virtual machine, and we could do it by setting, for example, the reasonable values into the registers. So stack pointer points to the topmost memory cell, so that is, there is no 1, so that is minus 1, perhaps. The frame pointer and extreme pointer also are not initialized in the beginning, so they might be set to minus 1. The broken counter We said program execution starts at address 0 in the code address 0, so therefore we may set it to 0, and the new pointer points to the topmost occupied memory cell. Nothing is occupied, so that would be the first address beyond what is the legal address, so it is max, yeah, because perhaps the memory is addressed from 0 to max minus 1. Okay, so that would be decent initial values for our registers. Now then, let us look what happens to our program. So our program consists of a sequence. So we assume that it consists of a sequence of variable definitions followed by a sequence of function definitions. So clearly this is not completely true. It could be so that you have some variable declaration, some function declarations, another variable declaration, and so on. But here for simplicity, we assume that they are sorted in such a way. And then there is also something that there is one particular function, which is the function main. And then we assume if we have such a sequence of function definitions, then the convention would be that program execution starts with a call to a function with this specific name main. So I guess that's the C convention, and in a certain sense this is also has been adopted by various other programming languages, including Java, for example. And if we have these variable declarations and function declarations, what do we have to do? Well, we have to allocate the space for the globals. We have to provide the code for the defined functions, and then we have to provide code for the call to main. And then the program if you execute that code, then the call to main would be executed. Now what happens at the end? So when main has terminated, somehow we have to terminate program execution, and for that we had this dedicated instruction halt, which then would be at the end. And this halt instruction is important as it allows to return control from our virtual machine to the operating system around. At some point, program execution must terminate. So that putting all these things together means if we have this code for the full program, and assuming that we have that the global variables consume space k, then we have to allocate the space for these. So I do that by calling alloc k plus 1. Why k plus 1? Well, if that means that I do not want for some reason to occupy the memory cell with address 0, and so therefore I can only allocate starting from 1, and if I need space k, then I have to alloc k plus 1, because stack pointer was originally set to minus 1. And likewise, the enter is set to stack pointer plus the value here, and I set it to k plus 4. This means So this is memory cell 0. This is the space k for the locals, and then I place on top of it. Where is it? Here is it. 1, 2, 3 cells, and these 3 cells are required for the for implementing the call to main, because we have to mark off main. I assume for simplicity that main has an empty set of uh, has an empty set of parameters. That is not true in C languages. In C programs, you could provide main with arguments. What for? Where do the arguments of main come from? Where do the arguments of main come from in Java? You have never written a Java program? From the command line. Thank you. Thank you. You rescued us. So they would come from the command line, and there you have to deal with strings and things like that. And so we kind of, I dropped that. But in principle, you would have to provide a mechanism for it. Yeah? Okay. So thank you. And now, okay, so that explains this K plus 4. And for the enter, the K plus 1 for the alloc. Now comes the mark, as I have said, that is for marking off the stack frame, the first stack frame for the main function. Then we load the constant for main because we want to call main. And then we call it. And then afterwards, so then that is kind of now regular program execution would start if I execute that code. And then now what happens if the value, what happens with the value returned by main? So then we could kind of agree on multiple things, how we make that value returned by main available to the operating system. One possibility is to move it into the memory cell with address 0, which is usually forbidden for programmers, but we might kind of use it for the operating system. I don't know whether that is meaningful or not, but if we take that thing, we would kind of do this slide K. So this means here we have the return value, or I make it in black. So here is the return value, and we put it then by this slide K into this memory cell with address 0, and then we hold. Assuming that the operating system also is written in C, then perhaps this might not be a good idea to use this memory cell with address 0, but one would have to implement another convention how to communicate with the operating system. Okay? So that terminates, or this finishes the translation of C. Is there any questions concerning C? So if you are happy with that, let's now proceed to unknown territories, namely to functional languages. So functional languages is a different class of programming languages. And actually, as perhaps Stefan has explained, in the old days there was only Lisp, and later people found that Lisp is a little bit boring and does not support modern principles of which one would like to have in programming languages such as types or something. So therefore, people came up with new definitions of functional languages, which then led to languages like Haskell or OCaml or things, or SML. And originally these implementations were extremely slow. And then people tried to, because there are concepts in these languages which make them distinct from imperative languages, and people for some time believed that they need completely new ideas to implement it. And then later they observed that a systematic way of producing code for these languages is via virtual machines. So that was, and we will present for here one such virtual machine. And by presenting it, you will notice that although it is for a different language, class of languages, the ideas which we have developed for C can be carried over in a modified way to solve that problem also. So here we start with a simple language which I call spoof pure functions. And so that is a minimalistic in that sense that it is not minimalistic in that it is a subset of functional languages, for example, a subset of OCaml or a subset of Haskell. So real-world programming languages need to deal with real-world problems, and there you need typically side effects or sophisticated data structures or exceptions. Later, to a certain extent, we will then consider extend our minimalistic language by providing data structures. We also will provide exceptions. Side effects are not so difficult to add. We will maybe either in exercises or I think in exercises we might speak about that. So here is now how this programming language might look like, and I have tailored it in such a way that you can consider it as a subset of OCaml. So the we have basic so a program in a functional language essentially is an expression. So this is important. It is an expression. So it is not like statements or blocks or something like that. It's just an expression. And so now an expression might be a constant. It might be a constant. It might be a variable. It might be an operator application, either unary or binary. Or it might be more complex kinds of expressions. So the first row of expressions perhaps does not come at a surprise. The next comes perhaps comes perhaps more at a surprise. Also, if then else, so conditional branching is done by means of expressions. So you have a condition which you evaluate. And depending on the result, you return either the result of expression E1 or as an expression, the result of the expression E2. So it corresponds to another operator, which is like, how is it written? So it is like that operator. You have the E0, then you have this question mark, then you have an E1, and then you have a colon, and then E2. Yeah? So in that sense, the conditional expressions are also available in other languages, for example, in C. So, but these are the only kind of conditionals you have in functional languages. Then, since functional languages as the name says, everything there is constructed around functions. So the key operations, the key things are therefore you have to write down functions, and you must be able to apply functions. So writing down functions, now let us see how this is to be understood. So by the way, before I continue with all that detailed explanation, one more question. Who has ever programmed in a functional language? You have not programmed, but you come from the TUM. You have studied at TUM, or where have you studied? Hmm? So, but there is informatic too.
Yeah, but I didn't do it. I didn't do it. It was
special
games engineering.
Ah, you are a gamer. Ah, interesting. So that is kind of, so otherwise you would have seen that. So now this is something, it sounds, well, actually, so a functional programmer, this is not worth mentioning. It is kind of you should read it as such. You have formal parameters x0 to xk minus 1. And given somebody, if somebody gives you the values for the formals, you have to compute something and return a result. And what you have to return is this one. So that is the body of the function, if you like. And the whole thing can be considered as a, if you like, what people have, it is a function without names. So it's a one way, it's a one times function. So that is a concept which people have only recently added to Java, because it turns out that if you need a certain functionality, and what do you have in Java to do? You have to provide a class, and inside the class a method, and inside the method then the definition of the method. And then you have all that notational overhead to implement a name, a class which is only for that purpose, and a method which is only for that purpose, and so on. And so that was kind of a nuisance. And then they have provided a special notation for such a nameless method, which you simply can use by, and you write down the, you have to specify what the formulas are, you have to specify what the body is, and that is what you do here. And so in that sense, only that these functions are kind of much more first-class citizens in functional language than they are in Java, where they are kind of an add-on, a complicated add-on, I think you need extra, they have kind of put quite some effort to produce, to pimp up the type system to allow these closures to arrive inside. But it's I would say it's notationally still complicated, and so here in functional languages you write it down and then you have it. Okay, so that is a kind of a function, but clearly you can also, so maybe let us here look at how you might write a little program. You kind of, if you want to write down the factorial, you can do it in such a way, you introduce a name. By means of the let, you introduce the name, and the name, the value of the name, is a function. So it is a function which takes an argument x, and then given the x, it returns the value of that. And here this expression may refer to the, since it refers also to the to the name which is declared here, you have a recursive definition. And that kind of recursive definition, you have a recursive definition, you should indicate by this rec keyword. Yeah. So when you see that, you see one more concept. You have by let you define a local definition of a variable x. You define locally. You say, okay, so now I introduce the x. So here the factorial, and then later I may use it here. Yeah? And so this let could also be nested. So you could have could have arbitrarily deep kind of lets nested into one each other, and by that having scopes which are kind of very fine-grained. So perhaps those of you who did a little bit of functional programming, so you would say, this is contrived. Why should I write it in that way? I could this definition also write like that. Let rec factorial of x equal, and then comes this if blah, 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 in factorial of 7. So you see here, instead of having the axis here, the formulas on the right hand side, you could also mention it here. So then it looks more like a function definition in an imperative language. But this is only syntactic sugar, they are equivalent. And I have done it here in the to make our lives easier, so that I have kind of a canonical representation. So I clearly separate the binding of a name to a value and the definition of a function. A function is nothing else but a specific value. and a variable name is nothing and a name a variable is nothing else but a name for a value, so that the factorial is not, it is denotes a value, namely the right hand side of this equality. Okay, and this value could be a function. Okay, so that means now I have, so here I have this mechanism of introducing variables, so by means of this let. Here I have the possibility of introducing recursive definitions of variables. That means the x1 to xn are simultaneously defined. That means the x1 can already refer to the xn, and the xn can refer to the x1. While here, if I have a non-recursive definition, the e1 may not use the x1. Or it may use, but then it is perhaps unknown. Okay? Okay, so that by that I can... So this let is the mechanism of introducing names. And values are constructed, so a function is a value. So these kind of basic values, variables could be values, operator applications return values. And another possibility is by applying a function to arguments. That also would return a value. Yeah? Okay. Now the question is what kind of... two more things. So just by looking at that particular example of a functional program, you may notice that there are no types, no type declarations. And that is, you might say, there are no types. And that was the old point of view of Lisp, that there are no types. Everything is... At runtime, you check whether something is a function or a number, and if you make an error, then you call something as a function, which is a number, and then you get a runtime error. In modern languages, there are types. The only thing, modern functional languages, there are types, but you don't have to spell them out. There's something like type inference, which infers the type of variables and of expressions. So, for example, in this particular example, OCaml compiler would note 07, that's an int. Factorial, therefore, must be a function which takes an int and returns something. Now the question is, what does it return? Okay, so that is a value which is possibly returned by the factorial. This is also an int. So therefore, in the else case, the OCaml compiler checks, okay, the argument, I assume that this is an int. Now here I have the assumption that the factorial returns an int, then I have to call the operator times. Multiplication takes this times indicated by in OCaml it's a star. So the star operator then takes two ints and returns an int. So therefore, indeed, not only in the then part, but also in the else part, an int is returned. So everything is fine here, and the type of the factorial is int, is this one. It takes an int and it returns an int. So that's kind of the reasoning, or in the example, the kind of reasoning which the OCaml compiler would do. So here for the moment we don't care about types, but we keep in the back of our minds, that there are types and that the compiler checks whether the program is well typed. Yeah? Is there a question concerning types? So I guess here in Info 2 we have a kind of more or less an extensive discussion on OCaml and the semantics of OCaml. We do, and a little bit we talk about types, but not so much. There is in this lecture on compiler construction by Michael, there might be a little bit more about types. So types is an interesting area. So think of In Java, there you have, for example, you have also types. You declare variables with their types. And then only for expressions, then the compiler checks whether variables are applied according to their types. So in this sense, functional programming is a little bit more advanced, since you do not even have to mention to give the names the types of names, and that would also be inferred by the compiler. And I guess so. I think there are now certain shortcuts. I know that they are in C#, but perhaps they are also in Java, because there is, for example, if you have you write a complicated type expression, and then you write new, and then you write the same complicated type expression. But if I create a new thing for some class, then the result is something of the class. So these two types should be the same anyway, and there might be, and it's repetitive and error prone, and so one might only mention one of them. I don't know whether, so there is var concept in, I think it's in C#. Is it also in Java meanwhile? That you can write var x and then u and then write only the class? You have not seen that. So maybe it will come. So then there's one more point. And that is a serious point, because that is everything here is serious, hopefully. And it is serious in that sense, because it refers to the semantics of what the program means. Because if there are different semantics, then we have to take care of in the implementation. It's clear. And so now there are two possibilities how you can give semantics to a functional program. And that is either using call by value, and this both refers to parameter passing in some sense. One is call by value, and the other one is call by need. And so these come to these two kind of, if you like, philosophies for parameter passing, are prototypically realized in two different classes of languages. One is the SML type of family of functional languages, where OCaml belongs to, and the other one is the Haskell type. So SML and OCaml adopt call by value. So this is parameter passing similar to what goes on in C. And call by need is a different type of parameter passing. There people think why should I evaluate an argument if I never will use it? The same as what?
Lazy.
It's kind of it's a form of lazy evaluation, yes. And the idea is I do not evaluate an argument if I do not need it. But the naive programmer might ask, why should I pass a parameter if I don't need it? And but it could be that I need it only to a certain extent, and then I would like to evaluate it only to a certain extent. And that's kind of what people sometimes call lazy evaluation or call by need evaluation. And here we will consider both modes and provide translations of both. Okay, so now let's go. So we have now a vague idea what might we be confronted with in functional languages. We will have to discuss everything in detail, because otherwise we can't generate code. But for that we need a general setting how our machine should look like. And here we simply say, okay, so the machine which I will present to you has a name, and this is so this is nothing to do with family romantics or so, but the Mama means Maurer machine, and Dieter Maurer was kind of the the architect of this machine. He was a researcher at Saarbrücken for some time in the 80s. And he came up with that machine, and I simply call it still like that. Okay, so now the idea of this machine is, we are so happy with our C machine, we use it. We don't do anything special. We try to use what we know and not to invent something new. So therefore, there is something which we would kind of not give up easily, which is our code store, and it is again called C, and you have a PC, a program counter, pointing to the next instruction to be executed. And then there's another thing which we do not want to depart with, and that's the stack. But that's now just a stack. So this is a stack, and there's no heap data structure on the other hand, so it's just a stack. And we have again, it is indexed, so we can have direct access to the elements of that stack. There is a topmost stack element which is pointed to by a stack pointer. There's also a frame pointer pointing to a current stack frame, if we have some. So that's it. There's no extreme pointer because the stack is only the stack. There will be no other data structure inside this same memory portion, inside the same memory segment. And now comes, that is something which is now new, and that is because for our functional language, we adopt something which we have already talked about. We adopt automatic garbage collection. So that is, we have a managed heap. And so for that to deal with is that we do not have pointer manipulation in a way as we have it in C, but only implicit pointer manipulation. So that means we have, and in order to have this managed form of a heap, we have to decide on what is the precise format of the elements in the heap. So therefore, all these are built up in the following way. They consist of a tag, and then they have a vector of values or pointers. Either it is just a value, so then there's no vector, or it is precise. Either we have a tag and a value, or we have a tag and a vector, and the vector may consist of code pointers or pointers to other elements in the heap. Yeah? And here is, that was kind of the macroscopic view. Now let us zoom in and see what kind of objects we have in detail. So I said we have some data in the heap. And that is, since the only basic value, so in the real functional languages you might have multiple basic values, you might have booleans, you might have ints, you might have floats, essentially these. But here we kind of, for simplicity, we only have ints. So that is kind of a deviation of what functional languages typically do. They make a clear distinction between Boolean values and ints, in contrast to C, where that is the same thing. But here, we simplify, we have only ints as basic values. And the basic values which reside in the heap have a tag, B, like basic value, and then just a field containing the value. Okay, so then we have more things to do. Maybe I continue with that last thing. So in some cases, we have to collect a sequence of references to other heap objects, and these we collect into a vector. So this vector is indicated as we identify a vector by the V, Then we have, clearly, if it's a vector, we need the size of it. And then we have an array of references. Okay, so this is a vector. A Boolean value vector, so that seems natural to us. Now what else do we have? Now then we need specific things which we need to deal with functional programs, and the most important thing is the notion of a function. So as I said, a function is a value, and that means it must be represented, and it must also be have a represent. In particular, it must have a representation in the heap. Now, what constitutes a function? So a function in C constitutes essentially only a single thing, namely a function in C is an address, a code address. So here, in order, a function must also kind of contain the start address of the code for the function, because otherwise I can't call it. But since we are in a functional, since functional languages are more, in a certain sense, more expressive than C programs, there could be more things. So a function could have global variables. And so we need to know what are the values of the global variables. So for that, I need an extra component in my function which maintains a vector or a reference to a vector holding the values for the globals. Okay? And then there is another thing. This is this AP or argument pointer. This means it could be that some of the arguments of the functions have already been provided. So if you have a function with 20 arguments and I apply it to 5 arguments, okay, so what is the result? The result is a function which will take now 15 arguments. And only if all the 20 arguments are available, the function can execute. So, but that means we could have functional values which are functions which have been provided with a subset of the arguments. And now where do we represent them? Where do we store them? Well, we construct an argument point, a vector for the arguments which are already there, and store that a pointer to that vector inside this functional object. Okay? So that is a functional object. And then there is another beast, which and that is now... So if you come to think about it, then these functional objects are meaningful. Now then there is something which the functional people call closure. And that we will kind of encounter when we try to realize this, as you called it, lazy evaluation. Or as I said, call by need. So that you have a function, you pass an argument to it. The argument is an expression. And now if one is in this call by need discipline, then we are lazy. We do not want to evaluate this expression. So, but we do not want to evaluate this expression if we don't need it. So we postpone it. But how can we postpone the evaluation of an expression? So the idea is kind of to encapsulate all the information to evaluate this expression into an element, and this is this closure, and store it in the heap. And later, when we find, oh, yes, this value, we really need it, then we take the closure. Now this closure contains all the information needed to evaluate it. We evaluate it, and then we have the value. So that means, given an expression, the closure must contain all information. The closure for that expression must contain all information necessary to evaluate this expression. So here, therefore, a closure consists. So the closures which we will then use for that purpose consists of two things. One is a code pointer. This is the code for the expression, which we then will evaluate when we require the value. Together with such a global pointer, which is a pointer to a vector containing the values of all the variables occurring in the equation, in the expression. Yeah, if the expression is x plus five, no, x plus y, then and we do when and we hesitate to evaluate x plus y, then we construct a closure consisting of a pointer to the code where x plus y is added, and the information about the values of x and y. And this is the global vector, which is pointed to by this GP. Okay? So I hope you get an intuition what these kind of data elements are used for in the heap. When we come to the particular case, how to realize a function, how to realize a closure, we will take up that and come back to it and explain it once again. Okay? So, but I hope that you kind of, at least for the moment, you should note that these kind of, these four types of data elements could be useful, and that, and record, keep in mind what they are, and then we can refer to it when it comes to the details. Okay? Okay, so now if you have an object, then you have to want to create it. So if you, so this heap, now, okay, so I did not tell you how, so here is, I told you we will use such a heap, so this is great, but how will that heap be implemented? So that is perhaps a natural question which you might ask, and I would, my answer is, it's up to you. So it's kind of an abstract data type. It allows us to create objects of this type in the heap and to access elements by following references. Yeah? And, yeah, so, and clearly the efficiency of an implementation of a functional language depends on how efficiently such heap data structure, how efficiently the data structure for such a heap is realized. So, but this data structure for these heap elements requires an operation, or provides us with an operation new, so that we can create a new such data element inside the heap. And this new instruction requires the tag. If you like, this is the class of the thing, and the arguments to be stored in that. In this data element, and when you call that new, the a reference to the this, a new such element will be allocated, created, and a reference to it returned on the stack. Okay, so that's that was for the heap. Now comes one more thing which we have to note, that there is what kind of code do we generate. And so we had in when generating code in for the C machine, we noticed that the same expression, for the same expression, we could generate different kinds of code. So there was one code if we want, if the result should be a value or if the result should be an address. So this was this code R and code L. And here, interestingly, for the same expression E, we also have different kinds of, we can generate different kinds of sequences of code depending on the use which we later on will make of it. So the first thing, a natural thing, is this code V. The code V, or the, so this is a, for the expression E, we then would like to generate a sequence of instructions which determines the value of E. Now the question is, how is the value returned to the context? And here the idea is that a representation of the value is created in the heap, and on the stack you only return a reference to it. So this is like if you think of, you have a Java program and you do not compute with ints but with integers. If you a function returns an integer, it does all kinds of computation with numbers, and then but returns the number not directly as a result, but it only returns a reference to a memory region, if you like, where the value has been stored, namely to the object of type integer. So this code V, in that sense, returns a reference to a value which lives in the heap. Okay, so but sometimes it is better to have the value on the stack. So in particular, if it's numbers, because think of that arithmetic, at least as we provided it for the C machine, took its arguments from the stack and returned its value on the stack. So if the value of an expression should be returned directly on the stack, then we may use a modified sequence of instruction. This is this code B. And then we also have a final kind of, a third kind of code which we may generate for an expression E. This is this code C. Code C is a sequence of instructions produced for E, but this sequence of instructions is not meant to, at runtime, when executed at runtime, to determine the value of E, but only to determine a closure for E. So this code C we would call, for example, for the arguments of a function when we are in this lazy mode. Okay? And that, I would say, concludes it for today. And next we start then by looking at simple expressions, how this code V and code B instruction sequences might look at like. Thank you for your attention, and we meet next week again.